Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. And this is a special episode. This is not in our usual run of episodes for this podcast. We are recording this about a week and a half after the 2020 election. So as of the time we're recording this, Joe Biden has been acknowledged by most people, though not the current president, actually, that he is indeed the president. And we're thinking by the time you hear this, I mean, some of you will hear it when that remains the case, and some of you will be hearing this perhaps when the new president has already taken office. But we are basing this podcast on the same 7-word formula that it's based on for couples therapy. You know, we call this couples therapy in 7 words. And I was realizing, and Judy and I were talking about it, that the 7-word formula that we use to heal couples is also applicable to healing our nation. So that's what this particular podcast is all about. So Judy, why don't you tell folks what the 7 words are just to get us started?
Sure. It's be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
So 3 parts to that formula: be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And I want to go over each of those 3 parts because I think in terms of healing a nation, it's as good a blueprint as it is for healing a couple. So what do we mean by be kind? First of all, kindness is not merely about being nice to people. Of course, that's a fine thing to do, but I mean it in a much deeper sense. Kindness is about recognizing kinship. You know, it's true in a couple and it's true in our nation that even as we acknowledge that we have differences, and of course, that's true between individuals and it's true between groups, that we are all, and I'm speaking to Americans here, we are all Americans. We are all part of a set of ideas. And you know, I wanted to relate this to someone who died very recently, actually, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who just died within the past week. And he spoke a lot about some really telling differences between where he was from, he was British, and his experience in America. And he would speak especially about his experience visiting American monuments in Washington, D.C., for example. You go to the Lincoln Memorial or the Jefferson Memorial or the Martin Luther King Memorial or places of that where we celebrate some of our leading lights in the ideas of our country. And what do you see around those memorials? You see text. You see ideas. You see the seminal writings of those people. Because what makes us American, to be an American is to be part of a story. It's to be part of a set of concepts that were founded early on. And as, of course, many people have pointed out, they were founded by people who were very imperfect. And the execution of the concepts has been very imperfect. You know, the idea that says we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Well, of course, even when they were saying that, they didn't implement it that way. But the concept is still important. Everybody is valid. Everybody actually has a right to exist and to pursue their lives to the best of their abilities. And everybody has value in the eyes of each other and in the eyes of God. Mm-hmm. Those are really crucial concepts. And he said what Rabbi Sacks would point it out is if you go to Parliament Square in England and you see the statue of Churchill, what it says on it is Churchill. In other words, they don't celebrate ideas there. The identity of being English is all about being English. It's all about that shared ethnicity. Of course, that itself is no longer true, but they weren't founded on ideas. They were founded on being this particular national group that evolved the way it evolved. But America is founded on ideas. And so what we can do with that is recognize our diverse identities, but nevertheless also recognize a shared identity, which is one of being Americans. And that's how we can be kind to each other in the sense of kinship. That when we recognize our kinship, we can deal with all kinds of differences about policy, even really serious, painful differences about policy, much the way a couple can deal with differences when they recognize their shared kinship. So emphasizing that idea that we are all part of a shared story, even with our differences, is, a path to healing. So first of all, I want to pause for a moment and see, because I'm kind of on my soapbox here, and I want to invite you, Judy, to react to that, especially if you can be skeptical about it.
Well, yes, I'm. I think in theory, it's absolutely wonderful. And yes, we should be kind. And I think that one of the things that we see happening in our country is a breakdown in civility. I don't believe civics is taught anymore in schools. I don't think there's a great understanding of how the government works. And I think that even some of our leaders don't have a great understanding of how the government works. So yes, we do want to be kind to each other, and we do have a shared history in that this country was founded by people who were seeking freedom, but at the same time, as we know, they were oppressing people. You know, Black men were not considered equal. Native Americans were not considered equal. Women certainly didn't have equality, but it is a good ideal to aspire to. But as we see more and more immigrant groups coming to this country, seeking those freedoms, seeking that ideal of America that can be a place to get ahead, that you can have a better life, it threatens the existence of the people who've been here longer, let's say. And in this case, we're talking about a lot of white Americans. You know, they see their place in society crumbling. They see job opportunities drying up. They see themselves being supplanted by people from other cultures that are eroding their cultures. You know, even something as innocuous as not being able to say Merry Christmas. That seems to be, what do they call those? Like a sticking point, a boiling point?
Yeah.
What's the word I'm looking for?
Certainly a flashpoint.
Thank you, flashpoint. That's the word I'm looking for. You know, then that makes the assumption that we're a Christian nation. So does that mean I can't say Merry Christmas? You know, and so it gets into all these things that people are feeling that, well, what is my identity if I'm not this white Christian male who has always had the upper hand and been in the upper echelons of at least not necessarily society, but at least the perceived echelons of society. So we see that happening. So it's difficult for some people to get past that and to show the kindness and to open their hearts and say, yes, we are this welcoming country. You know, give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Mm-hmm. That's on the Statue of Liberty, that great Colossus poem. I think many of us do believe in that and embrace that wholeheartedly, but you know, you gotta close the borders at some point. So,
yeah, I mean, that I think that's a nice segue actually into the second part of the formula, mm-hmm. because I think what you're describing, if I can sort of put it into the formula terms, is the reason it's so hard for people to have this sense of shared kinship, to be kind in that sense, is when they get into a panic. Mm. And the panic is when something seriously important is threatened. That's when we panic. And here I want to put in a plug, actually, for an article that our son Seth actually wrote, Seth Chalmer. You can find it on the publication Quillette. So if you do a search for Seth Chalmer in the publication Quillette, you'll find the article. And he talks about this phenomenon of people's identities, that if you try and talk someone out of their identity or attack the identity, almost certainly a human response to that is going to be to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see this with white supremacists, for example. If you argue with white supremacists, if you try and talk them out of white supremacy, it does not work. I can relate to that, because if somebody tries to talk me out of being Jewish, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And the difference, I claim, of course, between being Jewish or, let's say, being Black or, let's say, being Italian-American, you know, and obviously I don't have any expertise being Black or Italian-American, but I can relate being Jewish. The difference between those and being white supremacist is precisely that I can be Jewish and respect that not everybody has to be Jewish. In fact, I can celebrate that Black people can enjoy Black culture and Italian people can enjoy Italian culture, and, you know, from within, and still be Americans, as I can be Jewish and still be American. And the difference between that and white supremacy is it is an ideology, white supremacy is, that specifically excludes others. So the challenge, and this is what Seth writes about in his article, the challenge is, what do you do with identities that are damaging identities mm-hmm. to the country as a whole? And his solution to that essentially is to emphasize overriding identities that everybody can sign on to. That's the solution. So rather than, and you know, you hear this in stories of former white supremacists who then came to recant those ideas. And the stories you hear from such people is that they weren't convinced by people yelling at them or people condemning them. That just strengthened their resolve. What they were convinced by was people accepting them as people, accepting that they had valid reasons to feel the way they felt, and nevertheless, encouraging them to talk to other people as well and broaden their perspectives. So that when you had an overriding identity that was one that was accepting of others, then it became possible to let go of identities that were rejecting of others. And so you don't win people over by yelling at them and criticizing them and condemning them. You win people over by treating them as people. So the don't panic part of our formula, you know, what makes it possible to be kind is when somebody is feeling like they don't have to panic. And then what can happen is, and this is another frequent theme in, you know, in my book, which is Reigniting the Spark, which is where the formula is really laid out. A recurring theme is intimacy. When you can actually be in intimate conversation with people with whom you have big differences, you can do it by tolerating the anxiety of that difference without panicking. And then that's what allows for people to actually open up their minds. That's what allows for growth.
Well, yeah. The only thing is, if you're living in a neighborhood where people are like you, you're not going to come into contact with people that are, you know, have other identities that are different than your own. And the same thing with the fragmentation of our society. You know, if you're watching MSNBC, you're getting one perspective. If you're watching Fox News, you're getting one perspective. If you're, you know, looking at some of these really fringe online stuff, you're getting some weird perspectives.
Yeah, and of course, with respect to social media, the algorithms they use are quite deliberately designed to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to get rewarded for any sort of engagement with some particular kind of site with more extreme versions of the same.
Right. And, you know, it's, you know, feeding that fear that's causing the greater panic. So both sides are becoming more polarized.
Yeah.
So how do we get beyond that?
That is a great question involving things that certainly I am not expert in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you are either. And there's the challenge. You know, lots of really smart people are having trouble with this, but they're working on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key, though, is, well, first of all, I am encouraged by what I've heard so far from President-elect Biden,
mm-hmm.
who's talking about, coming from the top, talking about, we're going to emphasize our common connections.
Mm.
We're not going to ignore our differences, but we're going to emphasize our common connections. That's a possible way forward. I think they're going to actually have to be changes to how we do social media. I have some, you know, I wouldn't call this faith in the terms that we're going to talk about in a moment, but sort of optimism, I'll call it that. I have some optimism that when things happen that are causing harm, that we as a species are going to figure out ways of mitigating that harm. We've seemed to have done it in the past, and I suspect we'll be doing it in the future. So I don't know what's going to happen with the, you know, social media fragmentation that's been happening, but I'm hopeful that there will be ways that will be mitigated. It's always been true in our country that people have tended to live around people like themselves. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
not a new phenomenon.
Right.
And I'm remembering, I forgot who it was that pointed this out. It may have been Rabbi Sacks, actually. But the word politics comes from the word for polis, which means city.
Mm-hmm.
Politics is the way you manage power relationships in a city, and the idea of a city was that's where you come into contact with a whole bunch of people from different places. Whereas in your village where you grew up, everybody was pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And all the assumptions were not challenged. But when you get to a city, that's where you bump into other people. So I think, oddly enough, one way of answering that question, gee, how do we fix this? It's going to be through politics. And I mean that in a very positive way.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be through recognizing you have to balance lots of different forces with great respect for all. And I want to use that to segue to the third part of the formula, which is have faith. Because, you know, the way that I constructed the formula, be kind is important because that's what lets people have goodwill toward each other. That's what lets people, you know, feel good about being in relationship. And you can't be kind if you're in a panic, right? And we've talked about that. So the question is, how do you not panic? Well, the essential antidote to panic is faith. And what I mean by faith, I don't mean merely sort of blind faith that, oh, everything's just going to be fine so I can just sit back and relax. I mean sort of the opposite of that. No, I mean accepting reality, deeply accepting reality as right to be what it is, even when it's painful. And that's the antidote to panic. And I think that also allows us, well, let me expand on that a little bit. It's easy to accept the rightness of reality when what I see are people treating each other well. You know, when I how many of us don't, you know, tear up when we see these beautiful examples of kindness,
mm-hmm.
especially these days when there seems to be a shortage of it, you know? You see these wonderful examples, especially in social media, right? These wonderful stories about someone just being kind to another person and having it affect that person well. Expressions of love. It's very easy to have a sense that, oh yeah, reality is wonderful because it includes that. How do we manage to accept reality when reality includes hate and racism and violence and, you know, all kinds of things that most of us feel are bad and in some way? But there's some, well, here I want to tell a story about my work, which I've always found interesting. As you know, and maybe our listeners don't, I've done in the course of my career, I did quite a few years worked with lots of people who were dealing with trauma, having to recover from the effects of trauma, be it childhood trauma or, you know, childhood sexual abuse or trauma as adults, various kinds of trauma. And I was trained in some techniques for helping people heal from trauma. And this was not by no means a specialty, but I encountered in the course of my work over the years a number of people who had the diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder, DID, which is also known more popularly as multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And that multiple personalities is an adaptation, usually, to extreme abuse or chaos at very early childhood. That's typically when somebody has that. And the stories I would hear from such folks of what had happened to them were just horrendously painful stories. And even people without multiple personalities, I would often be working with people if there'd been, if they had survived trauma of one kind or another, who had a part of themselves that was self-destructive. They would hurt themselves, you know, cut themselves or do various things that, you know, the caring part of me just wanted to say, you got to stop doing that. You can't keep hurting yourself. You know, we have to banish those parts of you.
Yeah.
And certainly people with multiple personalities, there would often be someone, one of the personalities that would be really dangerous in some ways, either to themselves or to someone else. And so as I say, my instinct was to reject those parts of people, you know, was, well, we can't let that part exist,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that never worked. I learned that early on. I learned that way before I'd ever worked with people, at least that I knew of, who had multiple personalities. I learned that with people who cut themselves, actually, that if you try to banish that part of someone, it wouldn't work because it turned out that part had a reason for existing that was important. And it wasn't until I developed that kind of faith, that sense that who somebody is valid even when there's part of it that is bad, you know, part of it that, again, I wouldn't want somebody to keep cutting themselves. I would never say, oh, it's fine to keep cutting yourself. But I had to understand what it was about in order to actually help someone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, again, true of people with multiple personalities. Those parts of people that would be destructive typically when you were able to work with them long enough to assist in their healing, you'd find that it actually had a protective purpose, even though it was often doing some things that were really horrible. So that's true, I think, culturally as well. You know, racism exists, and all kinds of, you know, nationalism and ethnocentricity of various kinds exists as a reflection of how our brains work. We routinely lump together all kinds of things, accurately or not, in the interest of survival. It seems to have worked pretty well to get us here. It obviously has some very negative consequences in the grand scheme of things. But the idea that we invent concepts such as race is profoundly human. Mm-hmm. Race itself is an invention. I mean, race itself doesn't have any actual, you know, scientific, oh, this is what determines, you know, there's no gene for race. But the idea that we lump people together as, you know, in our group or not in our group, the idea that we're tribal, that's very much a part of human evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We can't insist that people simply not be who they are. We have to figure out some way of overriding that or incorporating that into something that is actually positive, which brings me back around to the notion of being kind. When we have that faith, you know, if I have the faith that people who didn't vote the way I did are nevertheless valid people, they just see it differently from me. If I can really have that faith, I'm going to speak of them and to them differently from if I have simply rejected them as stupid. And we've had this conversation. I have seen that. I hesitate to use the term both sides. It's taken on a rather bad connotation
mm-hmm.
since what Trump had to say about Charlottesville. But nevertheless, I have seen that a lot on both sides of that particular electoral debate. The way people speak so contemptuously of people on the other side. And I think as a beginning, we can at least resolve, if you can actually accept that faith as a practice, as a spiritual practice, I'm going to know that everybody involved in this whole business is a valid human being, and I'm going to speak of them and to them in that way. And I think that goes a long way to get past the panic, which in turn, then you start seeing, oh, we have some things in common.
Well, I think that, it has to come from two places. One is top down, and one is your family.
Mm. And yeah, say more about that. Yeah.
Well, you know, what we say that, you know, politics is all local, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everything first starts within the home and within the community. You know, you see it in school children. If they are coming from a home where racism is tolerated or promoted, you know, a five-year-old doesn't know the difference between somebody who's white or black or brown. And they come into school, and if they're making statements against a person of a different race, chances are they're hearing it at home from their parents. So it's really got to come from the family,
mm-hmm.
you know, the family dynamic. And top down, I think what you said earlier with Joseph Biden and the remarks that he was making, I think just seeing his family and Kamala Harris's family up there it's a larger reflection of the you know, the color of America these days. I'm hopeful because I see us as becoming a more colorful society, shall we say, with intermarriage that's on the rise. I mean, can you imagine 50 years ago if you said to a gay person, oh, you're going to be married someday? They would have said, you know, you're crazy.
Well, 50 years ago, I would not have known the word gay. And if I did know the word gay, I wouldn't have been speaking to a gay person that way. It's just, and I think it's just a difference between you and me, as a matter of fact, because I think the stories you tell of when you were in high school, it's like, no, you had a bunch of gay friends.
Right.
When I was in high school, I'm 6 years older, just for our listeners. So, you know, it's that much of a difference that when I was in high school in the 60s, not so much the 70s,
mm-hmm.
The language was very different even then. But your point, of course, is right on.
Right. I mean, you know, at one time, interracial marriages were illegal in this country. You know, gay marriage was illegal. And there are still people that oppose it. And it's very threatening to their way of life. So I think we have to be understanding on both sides that says, you know, you might not believe in it, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't take away our rights to live this way.
Yeah, I think the experience of gay marriage and more generally acceptance of people who are gay has been fascinating, you know, when you think about it, how quickly, in political terms, how quickly that has turned around based on there being an acceptance from the top.
Right. And because, you know, as more and more people are coming out and their family, they have a choice. Am I going to accept my child or am I going to throw them out? Well, some of them break off all contact, and I don't know percentages here, but I'm hearing more and more families being accepting of their, you know, gay son or daughter or, you know, trans. I think they're having a moment now, too, that's starting to come around. It hasn't gotten to the acceptance point yet of, you know, gays, but certainly it's coming around a lot more than it had been even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So that makes me hopeful.
Yeah. And, you know, through that all, I think we have to be aware of, you know, the phenomenon of backlash, which maybe, you know, you could in some ways look at Trump's election as a backlash to having actually, you know, elected a black president. That phenomenon is real. It has its reasons for existing. But over the long, you know, I'm always quoting this as Martin Luther King about, you know, the arc of justice is long. The arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. But I think he was actually quoting someone else. But in any case, that concept that if you take the long view, things are moving toward justice. Things are moving toward a sense of accepting people as valid. And I think that is encouraging.
Right. And I think, you know, we have to look at the whole human race is evolving constantly. We're not the same as we were 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, even 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. People have always crossed borders and empires have come and empires have fallen. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens to our country and where things are headed. So hopefully our civilizations, as we evolve, will come to a place where there's greater acceptance of people from all different backgrounds. And I think we're moving in that direction. At least I'd like to hope so.
You know what that makes me think about is often I remember, you know, right after 9/11, where we had a good 10 or 15 minutes where Americans were united because we had a common enemy. You know, we were a common threat. And I'm hopeful perhaps that climate change can be that threat. I mean, I'm not happy about climate change. Don't get me wrong. But I'm saying I'm hopeful that we can unite. Not only as Americans, we can unite with the world around recognizing that this is a common threat to our species.
Right.
This is a common threat to the survival of humanity.
Yeah, it's our whole planet is at stake.
And that perhaps can induce us actually to work together. And yes, I know there are elements of that particular crisis that can also induce us to, you know, circle the wagons and say, well, we're just going to keep all the resources for ourselves. But I'm thinking that if we can actually see ourselves as a common humanity threatened by some really dangerous outside forces, that will have the effect also of, you know, inviting us to be kind to each other. So maybe we can end on that note. I just want to reiterate that this concept of be kind, don't panic, and have faith, I'm thinking is a useful way of understanding not only how you can heal a couple, but how you can heal a nation that has been in a crisis of an internal crisis of feeling like internal betrayal. You know, the way a couple feels when there's been infidelity. In some ways, I think our nation feels that way. And I think by focusing on our common kinship and getting hold of ourselves so we don't panic and practicing faith, and I say practicing because faith isn't something you just come to know. Faith is something you have to practice, that we can heal as a nation. And so on that note.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I think that's a great note to end on. And, you know, listeners, we're always curious to get your feedback. So if you would like to send us an email, email us at bruce@brucechalmer.com. Or visit brucechalmer.com and leave your feedback on Bruce's website.
And when you do that, you can get all of our podcasts at the podcast tab there. There's also some other places. Really, anywhere you get podcasts, pretty much, you can get a hold of this, and we would really like to hear from you. And so, until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.